And you're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI, WBAI.org. On the web, it's 7 a.m. here in New York City. Coming up next, What's Going On with Bob Henley.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as the great world beyond. This is the Chief Leaders, Bob Henley, at Stuck Nation, because we surely are. This is WBAI's Drive Time News Magazine, What's Going On? And I am your Monday morning back-to-work, back-to-school host. Our focus is always labor. It's just after 7 a.m., February 7th. Sunrise was at 7 a.m. Michael G. Haskins is our audio engineer, and Linda Perry is our executive producer. Please be careful this morning because it's very slippery. The National Weather Service has issued a black ice advisory. Things will get above freezing by lunch, but expect rain on and off all day. Tomorrow through Sunday will be dry with temperatures building up to the mid-50s by Saturday. Sunday, looks like we will be back down to the highs in the mid-30s. This morning, we're going to focus on how labor is supporting the Poor People's and Low-Wage Workers' Assembly and Moral March on Washington on June 18th. We'll speak with veteran labor organizer Eddie Burke, who for over a half century has been in the thick of some of the most intense high-stakes organizing going back to the 1960s with the United Mine Workers. Today, he works with SEIU. We'll hear from Adam Thiessen, who is a barista at One World Trade and is working with Unite Local 100. And of course, your calls at 212-209-2877. But first, we go to Washington for the Pacifica Network News.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
I had no right to overturn the election. The presidency belongs to the American people and the American people alone.
Former Vice President Mike Pence on Friday rejected a claim by former President Donald Trump that Pence could have overturned the results of the November 2020 election. At a Federalist Society conference, Pence commended the work of the Capitol Police during the January 6th insurrection.
January 6th was a dark day in the history of the United States Capitol. Lives were lost, and many were injured.
That came just as the Republican National Committee officially declared the attack as, quote, legitimate political discourse, unquote. The RNC also voted to censure Representatives Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, two Republicans on the House panel investigating the attack. The U.S. added nearly 500,000 jobs in January, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. President Joe Biden hailed the job growth and pointed out it's recently been bigger than initially thought.
We learned that job growth in November and December over last year was revised up by more than 700,000 jobs.
South Dakota has become the latest state to adopt a measure banning transgender girls from school sports. Governor Kristi Noem signed the bill into law on Thursday. Supporters of the move argue it will ensure fair competition in school sports. But Catherine Oakley with the Human Rights Campaign says the law further ostracizes trans students.
They're normal kids who are going through all of the things that normal kids go through. And on top of that, they have a legislature that continues to attack them year after year after year.
The 2022 Winter Olympics officially kicked off in Beijing Friday with a few notable absences. The BBC reports 10 countries led by the U.S. have diplomatic boycotts over China's human rights abuses. China stands accused of forcing Uyghur Muslims into forced labor camps in the Xinjiang region. In December, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki announced the U.S. wouldn't be sending diplomats to the Games, although American athletes are still competing.
U.S. diplomatic or official representation would treat these games as business as usual in the face of the PRC's egregious human rights abuses and atrocities in Xinjiang, and we simply can't do that.
The mayor of Ottawa has declared a state of emergency. A 10-day protest by truckers against COVID restrictions has closed access to much of the downtown in Canada's capital. A top Biden aide is warning a Russian invasion of Ukraine could come any day. In a round of talk show interviews Sunday, the White House National Security Advisor warned an invasion would bring a terrible human toll. The U.S. has been shifting troops across Eastern Europe and has placed 8,500 troops on heightened alert. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Mike Moen contributed reporting. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Thanks, Jonah. In local news, Mayor Adams finally weighed in on the Municipal Labor Committee and former Mayor de Blasio's controversial Medicare Advantage program, which has sparked both street protests and legal action by a growing coalition of municipal retirees who assert the change will boost costs to them while reducing their access to care. In a Sunday statement, Mayor Adams himself, a retired NYPD police captain, threw his support behind the city's plan, saying in a statement, quote, "The NYC Medicare Advantage Plus plan unveiled last year, the product of many months of negotiation between the city and the Municipal Labor Committee, representing more than 100 unions, will continue to offer premium health care coverage to retirees along with new and enhanced benefits. That is why, after a careful and thorough review by my administration, I'm announcing my support for this plan. I believe the new program will be in the best interest of retirees and the city's taxpayers who stand to save $600 million annually." He closed with, to all retirees, quote, "We assure you that the city has had and will continue to have your best interest at heart." So, close quote. The municipal retirees are planning a February 14th noontime protest, I guess on Valentine's Day, at City Hall. Also this week, Mayor Adams has made it clear he plans on following through with the termination of up to 4,000 city workers who've not complied with Mayor de Blasio's vaccine mandate. My colleague Richard Caffeine wrote about in the Chief Leader this week. Opponents of the mandate plan on rallying today at 11 a.m. at 9 Metro Tech Plaza, and then marching across the Brooklyn Bridge to City Hall. I'll be back with Eddie Burke on the other side of this great song by Leo Dorsey.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, about to slip down.
In the morning, I'm already up and gone. Lord, I'm so tired. How long can this go on?
Yeah, they're working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
Wow. Well, that sets us up nicely. Good morning, Eddie Burke.
Hey, how are you doing?
So by way of introduction, you've got quite a resume. You've been at the center of some of the toughest struggles. I think when we were having our little pre-interview, you mentioned something about why you never forget your anniversary with your wife. Could you just set this up for us? Because it gives us both the human interest and the history that you have been on the front lines of.
Well, obviously, I was married back in March of '69, and as I told you and others, that I was married on Saturday and was on strike on Monday, back when we were fighting for a black lung legislation, first at the state legislature, and then actually later that year, we were successful with good friends in Congress getting a federal black lung legislation passed. It obviously was, I was like 21, 22, It was one that was near and dear to me because my father, who had worked 26 years in and around on the coal mines for the same company, passed away with a massive heart attack when he was 47 years old on the job. And had my mother not been armed with an autopsy, she would have been one of those thousands and thousands of widows and family members not having any protection. And she was, when the Black Lung Bill was passed, she was in the early batch because of that wise suggestion from a person who will go nameless, said you better get an autopsy. And she, until she passed last year, was a Black Lung recipient that $600 a month was actually making the difference of keeping her in the working class.
Well, and it's funny, I come from Welsh coal miner stock up in Pennsylvania, and one of the sad things I live with is there aren't older folks around out of all that. And so you were involved with some very difficult things. Can you go back and talk about the Yablonski saga? And because one of the things that we, as you know, we do not teach labor history in America like we need to. If you could catch us up a bit, I know it's hard to compress such a difficult and sometimes tragic lived history, but bring us back to those days.
I would think that Jock Yablonski, who was southwestern Pennsylvania mine union official, was a product of the Black Lung Uprising because he announced his candidacy to take on the incumbent, Tony Boyle, in 1969 after the major Black Lung strikes, which created our election in the mine workers that November in 69. And that's where I got my, I guess, education by the seat of my pants was when, you know, the Black Lung strike, I was out with the pickets. I was in the march on the Capitol. The strike started in February in the southern part of the state, but it ended up had over 50,000 people in West Virginia alone, and it was starting to spread. But Jock Yablonski, I would like to think part of his frustration with the system. Keep in mind, John L. Lewis had retired a few years earlier, so his successor Tony Boyle was pretty much standing by the on the sidelines when major mine disasters were happening. He was taking the company line. He actually took the company line on Black Lung, but Jock ended up running for office. You know, there were all kinds of election violations and lawsuits, and he, his wife, and daughter were assassinated on New Year's Eve of 1969. So, obviously, you get this wealth of education in a compressed area of, say, 8 months or so, and then this happens, you know, you take note, so to speak. And, to finish that cycle, the actual election that Jock participated in 69 was overturned, and a group of insurgents led by Arnold Miller won in 1972. And by that time, I was pretty much well into the being an activist in the mine work.
Wow. Well, I guess that in some ways that Mr. Yablonski and what happened with his family, they need to be in our constellation of remembrance about Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. It fits all in the same constellation, does it not?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. I mean, you know, he took on the system it was almost, it was really insulting and sad how they just took the $150,000 and started. By the time everybody got their cut, the shooters in the actual assassinations were getting like $4,000 or $5,000. It was so obvious what happened. Boyle was convicted, died in prison, and you know, but that lit the fire. You know, that continued. One of the hard things about uprisings and insurgents, which I think we've got one now coming, but is keeping them fueled. And the miners, the Miners for Democracy, the Black Lung Associations, all across the different coal-producing states, is the fuel. And I think, you know, with what Reverend Barber is doing now with the Poor People's Campaign is just a natural fit that's happening here with all of the problems that's happening with Build Back Better and election reform and things of that nature.
So, you know, when I hear you describe the militancy, and again, I guess it's termed the Black Lung Wildcat Strike. So that was the case where this very much the members were leading the leaders, as you tell it. And I think that would be what we saw. If you could, you know, when folks look at the national news and they see Senator Manchin is representative of your state, and it's said that he's unassailable and can't be beat, not that Joe Manchin, not where Donald Trump carried by so many votes. But what you're telling me, when I factor in the amazing effort by the West Virginia teachers, one of the most important, labor victories, that strike, there's another part of West Virginia I'm hearing from you, which is very militant and courageous when it comes to labor.
Yeah, the amazing thing about the teachers' strike a few years back was it was about pension security and health care. And that, I think you can peel those away. That's probably becoming a more and more of an issue for all working people, because a pension plan nowadays is a thing of the past. Everybody's, wanting, here, we're going to sign you up for the 401k and you make this much contributions, yada, yada. But at the same time, my answer to all that is, what about the pension? And let me have an option for a 401k. That's what's happening now out there. And I think, when you're looking at, I used to make a joke that every 4 years, every time there was an election, depending on my preferences, I'd get to be called a commie or a socialist, all these different things, every 4 years, because that's the first thing they try to do is divide and conquer. Manchin is, now you can't, this morning I woke up at 6 a.m., I heard on the one channel that takes in a tri-state area, I heard two ads on the television. Over the weekend, I got my third mailing from this mysterious group. I heard that Mark Short, I think is his name, Mike Pence's former chief of staff, he's heading up a PAC that's paying out like $400,000 a week, wow, buying up airways for Joe Manchin. So I didn't go that far in school, but I add this up, and it's, why is a Republican PAC spending all this money on Joe Manchin? Sort of obvious what's going on here. It's all about thank you, Senator Manchin, for fighting Build Back Better. Thank you for focusing on our issues. But it's all paid for by out-of-state Republican money.
Wow. And Paul, if you want to get in on this, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. So one of the things, we like to make connections here, and one of the things that this is how I came across it, was one of these great Zoom calls that Reverend Barber convenes, which are just, media folks, do not miss these. They are really, they're underreported, but they are informative. One of the things you mentioned is that with torpedoing Build Back Better, Manchin is undoing an important part of the Black Lung funding piece. You can talk about that, because I've been watching this very closely, because we have tens of thousands of brothers and sisters, union folks, and just civilians who were caught up in lower Manhattan on 9/11, when the EPA said the air was safe to breathe, kind of like a much lower Manhattan was a coal mine. That turned out to be a lie, and thousands of them really rely on the World Trade Center health program, which is also caught up in Build Back Better. Like, how can he do that, knowing how important that bill is to the well-being of his state?
Well, he in my opinion, he's wanting to try he'll use this now as a crisis, create the crises that he can now come in and be the hero. But what happened with Build Back Better, Joe Biden, President Biden, had in the Build Back Better the funding mechanism for 4 years for the Black Lung Fund, which was a national fund set up by taxing the coal produced, and they had it set up on a schedule where they're paying like $1.10 per ton for underground and 55 cents per surface mine, things, a funding mechanism. And what happened was that that fund has, you know, has been, you know, with all the bankruptcies that's happened in the coal industry in the last decade, a quick side note, your song, the lead-in song, Working in a Coal Mine, I was sitting there sort of like saying, yeah, tell me about it. So there's been an 80% decline in coal miners in the last decade. There's probably not more than, 10,000 connected. That's everybody. Put everybody in the pot. That's in West Virginia right now. When in 1972, when I was, still coming out of the mines, working on these campaigns, we had over 100,000 people in West Virginia alone in the union. And
that's astounding.
But the Black Lung funding mechanism was part of the Build Back Better. So now you've got 30,000-40,000. Survivors and family members now wringing their hands wondering how this fund, which was in trouble because of all the bankruptcies, are now wondering what's going to happen. But you can bet that Manchin's going to try to get on his horse and ride into town and say, well, here's what we're going to do. And he'll cut a deal with Mitch McConnell and try to get this fixed. But the bottom line was his vote on Build Back Better, his opposition killed or postponed and prevented all this agony now, where you had a four-year spending mechanism, and now where's it going to go?
I want to ask you one important thing is that I know you have a mind towards the future because you're a student of history. Weren't there important provisions in there in Build Back Better to help the mining economy and miners make the transition into a world where we recognize climate change for what it is and start really cutting back on fossil fuel consumption?
Millions and millions of dollars was loaded in that package to help with the transition. I don't think you can ask hardly anybody. In my neighbor, two doors down, is working, and he's hoping he gets two more years. Everybody knows that coal is becoming, is a thing of the past. I mean, there's no getting around it. I mean, they've mined out most of the seams. They don't have a lot of it yet. And now the reason that there's the surface mining is so prevalent now is because they have to take off like half the mountain to get four or five little seams. So, it's been that way. I knew in the late 80s that, once you looked at the tree ridges up in New England dying of acid rain, and they had to do something. That's when I made my decision. I said, there's not enough time for me to get any retirement here, hardly. So I took my pension and went on to elsewhere. I stayed here in West Virginia the whole time. I've lived in the same house 47 years, so.
Wow. But,
it's there. I mean, you've got to, we have to figure out. Build Back Better had a lot of the business community. You'll be hard to get anybody to publicly say it, but they were getting excited about all of the different monies and training programs and transitions that would be coming along with Build Back Better.
So in terms of what's the case you make for people to get engaged with the poor people and low-wage worker protest that's going to happen on June 18th? What's the case you make? What's your coal mining shaft pitch?
It's a natural fit. You have to have a place. And, Reverend Barber just didn't come into town, last week. He's been around. His organization's been around for like 5 years. During the teacher strike, he was around. And he's got that staying power. That organization has the staying power to keep an insurgent group up and running. And I'll tell you who knows that is those people who are sending those big, fancy 8.5, 11.5 postcards to my house telling me that Joe Manchin's really fighting for me. That's who knows that Reverend Barber can do that.
And so as a practical matter, how do you see the connection with what's been going on with the Century workers? Because you have a broad sense of what's happening with your engagement for SEIU in current times. This whole business with the pandemic and the role that unions played in trying to protect people, we don't really even know right now, at least, you know, with the tragedy of a coal mine, we get a body count. But right now, sir, we have no idea how many essential workers, cops, firefighters, EMTs, nurses, respiratory therapists, retail workers. I mean, it's an army. We don't know how many of those good souls lost their lives because the government and their companies failed to protect them.
Well, yeah, there's no question that when you look at it, actually, I've seen studies now that black lung is in what few miners that are left, black lung rates are going back up. So that's just another example of what goes on here. And you know, I think by shining the light on this constantly, and that's what Poor People's Campaign does, in my opinion, is that, you know, more people like me helping out. This is not, you know, I'm 72 years old. I'm not looking for a job. I'm looking for something that's going to help my neighbors, my kids. You know, we're getting tired. Everybody said every election, they say, "Oh, I want to bring my kids back home." This politician will parade out his kids. The only way you do that was with a sustained organization, and that's what Reverend Barber has brought to us, and we are hopefully on the way up.
So, what are some of the coordinates that people should have if they want to get in touch with you? How can labor plug into this once-in-a-generation opportunity on June 18th?
Well, I mean, I'm a retired guy now. The Poor People's Campaign are obviously going to their website is what I've done. That's how I found out there was a big rally happening at our Capitol back in the fall. That was my first experience with it. I listened. I liked what I heard. And I followed Reverend Barber's Moral Mondays, just being an activist of sorts, back in North Carolina. He's the real deal. I think going to those websites, and it gets us all together. So I don't think, you know, there's all kinds of cross connections here. I came from coal. All of our coal went to the steel, U.S. Steel.
Right.
Yes, you know, then you got the steel mill workers. You've got all of these different cross connections, and just working people in general. I mean, never forget. And I don't usually get out of a conversation with a couple little nuggets for Joe Manchin. Is that he was the guy who said $15 minimum wage was too much. That $11 was what was, and that was in the rescue package. But on the Build Back Better, he thought that child care tax that the parents would spend the money on drugs. Think about that. There's plenty of outrage out there, and I think the Poor People's Campaign can really tap into that. And I don't see a lot of politicians at these events, and I don't think there's any wannabe politicians. They're just people wanting to hold politicians accountable.
Well, and that's exactly it. And Mr. Burke, you are an inspiration. Thank you so much for taking the time, and let's stay in touch.
All right. Take care. Nice talking.
Take care. That was Eddie Burke, United Mine Workers, and then also more currently SEIU, making the case for labor to get engaged in a big way in the June 18th Poor People and Low-Wage Worker March on Washington. June 18th, folks, write it down. It's going to be a focal point. We'll come back on the other side with this from Joan Baez with Adam Thiessen, Unite Local 100.
Under one dark and cold.
May the circle be unbroken by and by. So this is the point where we have to try to raise some money, folks. It's the only way we can make this happen. It's all connected. You heard Eddie Burke speaking directly from West Virginia. I have been having some success. I had this book out called Stuck Nation, Can the United States Change Course on Our History of Choosing Profits Over People? It's brought out by Democracy at Work, and it has a wonderful introduction from Professor Richard Wolff, economic update, no stranger to these airwaves. And I've sent several of these out. This is something that I will mail to you personally. That's right. I will get your address, and then I'll write it down and go to the post office and mail it to you. I will autograph it. And all you have to do to set that whole process in motion is 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, and contribute in the name of the show. $100 will get you this book. It just is something that I'd like to share with you. I have five copies that I can do this with. These are not free to me. And so I certainly think it's something we need to do to try to support the station. It's something that it's really up to you to keep this going. One of the things that we have that's a historical problem is what's going on with the media. As you know, it's very hard to hear anything like this. I don't think you would heard the name Yablonsky anywhere on the air. So it's one of those things where it's up to you to be able to keep this going. Think of it as a way you may not be able to make the June 18th march, but by supporting the station, it's going to be possible for people to hear about the march. And so that's what you can do. You can make that contribution. Any amount will move us forward. And so one of the things I think that you look at around at how the corporate media has dominated the landscape and squeezed out these messages. It's one of those things where, you know, we need you to step up right now. I think that one of the things that we know in our heart is that it often comes up to us to be able to do this. And one of the things that we see happening so often is that, you know, we don't see any reflection of the struggles we know we're having. And so that's why I need you to call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Make that contribution today. And then what we're going to do is we want you to also call in today. I'd like to talk to you. There's so much that's going on. We had, of course, Mayor Adams make that declaration. People were waiting and giving him a chance to see where he was going to come down on Medicare Advantage. He's now decided. Also today, we have the very serious business we're dealing with, the likelihood that thousands of New York City civil servants will indeed be let go as a consequence of what choices they made related to vaccination. So I think we want to hear from you today. 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. And when we come back on the other side of Joan Baez, we'll take your calls. That's right, 212-209-2877. Please go ahead and set up your call now. And also, one of the things that about this tower for power thing, this is the thing. This tower, this is a rent. You know it's a bill. It's huge. If we don't get it paid, then we're going to have a situation where, you know, we fall behind. And so far we've been able to keep current, but that's current. That is an iron current. It's the current of your interest. It's the current of you saying, this is worth my time. I'm going to be able to set aside a little bit of money to do this. And so that's why we want to hear from you now. And it's also, we want you to call in because this is an opportunity for you to set the agenda. 212-209-2877 to be part of the conversation. 212-209-2877. 2877 to be part of the conversation, to be part of the funding cycle that we need. 212-209-2950. And of course, if you make a pledge of $100, you'll get Stuck Nation. Can the United States change course on our history of choosing profits over people? So I guess one of the things that we, the other thing we have here, oh, here we go. I'll spare you that. Anyway, I'm happy to say that we have Adam Thiessen on the line. He's a barista in the, up in the World Trade Center and working with Unite Local 100. Good morning, Adam. Glad we connected.
Good morning, Bob. I'm not sure what the technical difficulties were, but I'm glad for the opportunity. Glad to finally get on.
Technical difficulties? What technical difficulties? Anyway, so... introduce us. I'm trying to present this intergenerational portrait here. We had Eddie Burke, who spoke so poignantly about the things he was present for in trying to make a difference for working people. What's your story? How old are you? Where'd you come from? And why do you care about the Poor People's Campaign?
Sure. So I'm 38. I'm from near Chicago originally. Just moved to the city. I'm very new to my local 100 Unite here. So I got into this. My dad was a machinist, IBEW Local 134 in Chicago. He voted for Reagan once and then realized that trickle-down doesn't work at all and raised me as a liberal. Kind of taught me to see things from a worker's perspective. I really started paying attention after 9/11 and when Bush was in office. And I remember Howard Dean's scream and just kind of realized that, man, this politics isn't working. So I moved to Maine. I began organizing there. Started with a program called Solidarity Harvest, which was really cool. It was solidarity between workers and small farmers, all of who suffer in Maine, distributing Thanksgiving meal baskets, but really supporting between the two groups. And then also food insecurity issues there. We had a raised bed garden project and also lobbied with the folks in the low-income areas where we had the gardens. Outside of this, though, the main thing coming out of Maine, there was something that was just organically built called the Greater Bangor Housing Coalition. Several of us camped out in solidarity with some unhoused folks at an encampment they had on the Penobscot River. We were there around 4 in the morning. It was 20 degrees out, and the cops shook us awake and kicked us out, told us to leave. They didn't care where, and so we, a lot of us kind of went over to the town square and just talked about, you know, pain and all the barriers that everybody faced. And really it was organic. It was decided then and there that a group should be formed and something should be done. So this group ended up being led by impacted people, unhoused people and people who formerly lived outside. And that's really what the Poor People's Campaign does. It's leadership by the most impacted. It's kind of building from the ground up. You know, any structure needs a strong foundation, and when you get top heavy, everything will crumble over. And that's kind of what we're seeing with our economy and wealth distribution in the country right now.
Well, and something I was introduced to during one of these Zoom conferences where I saw Mr. Burke make his case. What do you say to your colleagues that you work with? I mean, first set the scene, where you work, and what are the wage conditions like there?
Sure. So wages here, the company pays us as little as possible. Recently, my hours have been cut. With COVID and everything, the cafe has been a lot less busy. And so we depend on tips from the customers to supplement our income. And morally, morality is a huge piece of the Poor People's Campaign and really all of this work in this movement. I resent the fact that sometimes I find myself getting mad at the customers who don't tip. It's not their fault. It's the company's fault. They're the ones who aren't holding up their end of what should be the deal. And I resent the fact that I'm, kind of led to feel bad feelings towards folks who likely, maybe they're an office manager. They don't have, they're not getting paid enough either, And so morally, we're all in this fight. And I try to convey that my coworkers, we actually talk a lot, especially with all the downtime we've had. And something I've noticed, a lot of people don't feel like voting matters. Like, oh, nothing's going to change. There's just this overwhelming sense of, it's like accepting defeat before the fight even begins. And what I try to tell folks is that there wouldn't be all this assault on voting rights if voting didn't matter. And so with the Poor People's Campaign, that's a huge piece of this, is we're registering voters, we're educating voters and workers and impacted people to affect change. And that's really how it's done, is building from the bottom up.
Well, I saw that connection you made with voting rights and the active suppression that's going on around the country. In terms of, one of the things is that when you hear Reverend Barber make this case about, I guess there's 140, you may know the numbers better than I, but 140 million people in this country that are poor or low wealth or struggling, certainly week to week to make ends meet. That's a huge sense. That, I guess it's called the sleeping giant. What do you think it's going to take for people to have, particularly in a competitive society where we people don't like to think of themselves as struggling necessarily, and so there's isolation in the sense that people struggle often by themselves. How do you go about trying to build this consciousness of the fact that we are truly in this together?
Sure. So that number, 140 million poor and low-income people in the country, that's 43.5% of all Americans. That's 52% of children in this country, and that's a moral failure on our part. Building this power together. Yeah, could you repeat that question? I'm sorry.
No, so I was saying is like, how do you make the case? Because one of the things that people, we're in a competitive capitalist society. We are conditioned that we measure ourselves by the stuff we own. And so the idea is that the system is a great system. And if we're having problems, it's our problem. This you learn from grade school. How do you get people to step back? And I ran into this when I was involved with organizing around the foreclosure resistance movement. How do you get people to step back and realize that they're not the problem, that the system is?
Sure. Well, this is something I've run into talking with a lot of folks over the past couple of years, that poverty seems to be something that people are ashamed of. They don't want to acknowledge that don't want to acknowledge that we're poor. We spend money on things that don't really matter because we want to show status, whether it's, a fancy car or a phone or whatever. That's besides the point. We should be able to buy those things. We should not be ashamed to be poor. Being poor is not our fault, and the system beats us down. It is, if you're born on third base, it's a lot easier to score, to hit home. But if you're born in the dugout, how do you get up to bat and stuff if you're born in the minor leagues? So, the way through this is building relationships locally in your community, and education with this. We all have something to offer, and everyone has a place in this movement. Poor and impacted people are overlooked, not heard, and that just reinforces this idea that it's our fault, that we don't matter. And to tell the truth, impacted people, when you're impacted by whatever you're impacted in, whether it's homelessness or low wages or anything, you're an expert on that issue, and that's what we need to learn from. Just like we build from the bottom up, we want to learn from the bottom up. And once folks realize that and hear, and once folks see that they want to, or that people want to listen, everybody wants to speak about their own pain. Everybody wants to talk about, you know, how the deck is stacked against them. And when people are listening, it really gives some confidence, and people feel like they can, you know, go above and beyond. And I want to say that's what it takes. We all need to be uncomfortable. We all need to do things that we're not necessarily excited about doing. I am not the biggest fan of coming on the radio and talking to folks. But it's important to do these things that, you know, just put ourselves in an uncomfortable situation, and we can do a lot more than we realize.
Call us if you want in on this, 212-209, 2877, 212-209, 2877. One of the things that would you say that what's the biggest change in terms of organizing and raising the profile of these issues between Maine and New York City?
So Maine, it's very different. I mean, I moved here in September, and, you know, I have been up this high in Maine. It was on top of a mountain, and now I'm up this high in the World Trade Center. I'm looking down at New York City's financial district, and I look down physically, but I also look down morally, because there's hundreds of billions of dollars exchanging hands there. That's something you don't see in Maine. It's not in front of your face like that. But on my way to work, I literally step over, walk past unhoused people sleeping in the subway to stay warm, people who have been beaten down, and I, you know, folks, myself included, we all walk past folks and either, you know, glance away or move to the other side of the street. These are human beings, and we're taught in society that they're less than that. In Maine, I remember in Portland, there was a housing encampment, I spoke with a person, and he asked if he could sit down at the table I was sitting at. And it had been years since he had been able to sit down at a table in a public space. He goes to somewhere for water or something. And I want to listen to everything, but I had to fight back at some point, because he believed that he was less than human. He kept saying this. He called himself a zombie, and that had been drilled into him. And so you know, the biggest change in or difference between Maine and here, I think, will just be the scale, or at least the you know, in your face, the how visible it is. Certainly people are hurting all over, and geographically, we're all connected. We're all in the fight, and we're all siblings, you know.
Absolutely. I got to make sure to get you a copy of The Chief Leader one day. We got to connect and have coffee. We have a caller on the line. What's on your mind, caller? Where are you calling from, and what's your name?
Is this my turn?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Jose from Belleville. I think the key element is two words: money and resources. The workers, we have resources, mentally, physically, in their houses, but we don't have money, the paper money, to go to the bank and deposit.
Right.
That's my question to the speaker.
Sure, absolutely. And thank you for calling. One of the things is that Dr. King was talking about a basic income to support workers. And we know that, for instance, right now, and it shows you, there is $13 billion that's available for 5 million households, Adam, that have yet to file for the expanded child tax credit that was passed in the American Rescue Plan. Mm-hmm. And with the exception of some websites like Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, who has, you can go to that website and calculate with how many kids you have, what it helps you through the steps. People have no idea about this. So even when the money's made available, they don't go to the trouble to make it clear and help people get access to it.
Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, what I've found is a lot of folks are beaten down just from work, the amount of time that it takes. And by the way, you know, time is part of poverty, the lack of time to do things outside of work. I work with people here between their commute here, their shift, and their commute home. It's over 12 hours. This is over half the day. And we feel like we see each other more than we see our own families. And that's just not the way.
We have another call, but that's such a great point. Caller, where are you calling from, and what's your name? What's your concern?
Hey. Hi.
Hi.
Oh, hi. Well, you know,
at this point in my life, I look back and I'm going, I think one of the ways we could all make a major difference is if we all resolve our unresolved issues from the past, our family upbringing, whether it be because of outside influences in the family and economic reasons. When you get to a certain point and you're a responsible adult, or you want to be, you got to look back and think of that, because then when people get into certain positions, whether they're homeless or they have a job, you don't think those homeless people, when they go to a shelter, there's not issues going on? So it's the consciousness. So it's you have to look, realize that you shouldn't do things to other people you want don't want to do to yourself. But one of the blocks that happens is it's all this history from your family and stupid hurt things. So people have to resolve these issues, and as they go through life, our consciousness will change. Until then, it's going to be like, who can get what, when and where, and who you're connected to. Our consciousness has not changed. If you just want to go back 2,000 years.
I want to, that's such a great.
2,000 years ago, there were people making deals, and there was a Donald Trump, and there was an Obama.
You're so right, Paul. I do have one more caller. Thanks for calling. Call again. Thanks for calling. We have one more caller I want to get in before we have to close out the morning. Caller, where are you calling from? Make it quick. We have a little bit of time. Go ahead.
I'm in White Plains. It's Russell. I'd like to ask your union organizer, Bob, what you're going to do about the automation of the trucks, because now we've seen the truckers are a great political force by way of Canada. Are you going to do anything to oppose the automation of the trucks other than letting young guys drive trucks and crash them, because that's what they're looking to do? They're letting young people, inexperienced people, drive trucks. It's going to be a higher death rate, and then they're going to say, hey, let's automate.
Thank you. Russell, I wrote about that in the Chief. Thanks so much. Caller, do you, thanks so much for calling, Russ. Adam, I guess automation, that's one thing they want to do, is get rid of workers.
Oh, yeah, and that's been the case. I mean, there used to be all kinds of jobs, but, you know, chimney sweeps and stuff, and there's always there's always going to be progress, if you want to call it that. What we need to make sure we do is find ways to bring everyone along, because there's more to life than work. There, you know, family and spiritual growth, pursuing passions. You know, life is an amazing thing. We only get one of it, and we shouldn't be subjected to all of this oppression.
Well, listen, Adam, any coordinates so people get in touch with you in your efforts?
Sure. Well, the main thing I want to leave everyone with is on June 18th, the Poor People's Campaign is having, and this is a mouthful, the Mass Poor People's and Low-Wage Workers Assembly on March in Washington and to the polls. And what this is, we have hundreds of organizations throughout the country, thousands of people. And on June 18th, we're all gathering on the National Mall to declare that enough is enough, that we are done being oppressed. And this is, you know, there's lots of marches on Washington, and they're all good things. The thing that makes this different, there's next steps coming out of it. We're organizing at the grassroots level with the Poor People's Campaign. I believe we're in over 45 states. And to all the listeners, I want to personally ask you to come to June 18th if it's possible. You can get in touch on poorpeoplescampaign.org. You can find your state campaign. Come, bring someone with you. And if you're not able to come, find ways to help. There's a place for everyone in the movement, even if it's raising money. And all of the states, we're going to have buses to get people there at the cost they're able to give. So I'm sure all the states could use help with that.
Thank you so much, Adam, and we'll be in touch. That was Adam Thiessen, working with the Poor People's Campaign and Unite Local 100. Make sure to stay tuned for Democracy Now! And, of course, after that, at 9, Law and Disorder has the Reverend Dr. Barber. Don't miss that. And, of course, in this space tomorrow, Frenchie Davis. Thanks so much. Stay strong.
Fingers and toes. I wanna hear those tears at both of my ears when I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. On Tybee Island, off the coast of Georgia, climate change is hard to ignore. Rapidly rising seas and more extreme storms cause repeated flooding in streets, yards, and homes.
Many of the residents have lived there for a long time, and so they're saying they haven't seen anything like what's happened over the last few years.
Jill Gamble is with the University of Georgia Marine Extension and Georgia Sea Grant. She's part of a team working to identify ways to protect Tybee Island from flooding and erosion.
One of the most vulnerable areas for the island has been the marsh side, which is mostly private property.
So she says it's important to develop solutions that homeowners can support and include residents in the planning process. The team created a website where people can document local flooding, and it's been running public meetings and surveys to gather residents' input about a range of solutions, from creating green spaces designed to absorb excess water to offering property buybacks.
In doing planning, local knowledge and local experiences are so critical, especially if we're trying to create a sustainable, resilient future for a community. They need to be part of the conversation and part of the solutions that we're developing.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
And right before Climate Connections, Ann Feeney with, "We just come to work here. We don't come to die." This is listener-supported, commercial-free radio station WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Mondays at 7 a.m., Bob Henley. And the focus is always labor. And as you heard, tomorrow at 7 a.m., Frenchie Davis will be here. Right now, it's just shy of 8 a.m. in New York.